Smith and the City by P.G. Woodhouse, dramatised by Marcy Cahan. Episode 2, The Haunting of Mr. Bickersdyke.
In his snug little flat in Clement's Inn, Smith, the P is entirely silent, was demonstrating his expertise with the frying pan. He doled out breakfast to his old friend and new flatmate Mike Jackson with the air of a medieval monarch distributing largesse.
By Jove, Smith, this place of yours is all right.
Not bad. Free from squalor. Mind you, we are all campaigners, we Smiths. Give us a roof, a few comfortable chairs, a sofa or two, half a dozen cushions and decent meals, and we do not repine. Kidney?
Thanks.
Our second day at the bank looms, Comrade Jackson. We must fortify ourselves.
Bacon? Oh, better make it 3 rashers. We're in for a hot time, Smith. The man who runs the show hates our guts.
True. Comrade Bickersdyke is impervious to our charms. Disdainful of our commercial efforts, a tad over-eager to land us in the consomme. Nevertheless, we shall prevail.
How?
We must secure the cooperation of some friendly native.
Egg? Oh, thanks. Which native do you have in mind?
The head of our department.
Rossiter? He doesn't strike me as a friendly type.
Once I know that Comrade Rossiter and I are brothers, and that he will look with a benevolent eye on any little shortcomings in my work, I shall be able to pursue my campaign to civilise Comrade Bickersdyke. More tea?
Oh, no thanks, I've done. Pretty tough job turning Rossiter into a friendly native.
There is but one way. Do you remember the case of Comrade Outwood when we were at school? How did we corral him?
We joined his precious archaeological society.
Precisely. Every man has his hobby. In the case of Comrade Rossiter, I would say that it would be either postage stamps, dried seaweed, or popular fiction, the novels of Hall Caine. A few casual questions, and the thing is done. Good morning, Comrade Rossiter.
Get on with your work, Smith. We have a lot before us.
True, but how lucky we are to be in postage.
Eh?
With me, stamp collecting has always been a positive craze. Any philatelist would feel himself privileged to be installed at the New Asiatic. So many multicoloured stamps pouring in from every distant corner.
I have no time for such nonsense. If you mean to get on, Smith, I should advise you to devote more time to your work and less to stamps.
I have seen the light. Stamps? Mere bagatelles. Whereas dried seaweed...
Get on with your work, Smith.
Willingly, Comrade Rossiter. Work. The hobby of the philosopher and the poor man's friend.
The morning dragged slowly on without incident. Mike had to go out and buy stamps, which he subsequently punched in the punching machine in the basement, assisted by a messenger whose passion was roses. This confirmed Smith's theory. Mike knew about roses and made a firm friend of the messenger. He found Smith still baffled.
Hall Caine has also proved a frost. I wandered around to Comrade Rossiter's desk just now with a rather brainy discourse on Caine's use of the eternal triangle.
No luck.
The impatient frown rather than the glad eye.
They were interrupted by Bannister, a shock-headed youth with paper cuff protectors round his wrists.
Hello, Jackson. Had any trouble with Rossiter yet?
No, not much. He hasn't run you into Bickersdyke?
No.
Pardon my interrupting a conversation between two old college chums, but did I hear the name of Comrade Rossiter?
Who are you? This is Smith, chap I was at school with. This is Bannister Smith, who used to be on here till I came.
The very man I have been looking for. During your stay in this excellently managed department, you had many opportunities of observing Comrade Rossiter?
Should jolly well think I had. He was always popping out and cursing me about something.
What used you to talk to him about?
No, I didn't. He did all the talking.
This is unfortunate. You see, Comrade Bannister, I find myself at a loss for the appropriate subject to divert and amuse Comrade Rossiter. My numerous shortcomings provide him with ample material for speech. I, on the other hand, am dumb. I have nothing to say.
I should think that was a bit of a nice change for you.
Perhaps so. Perhaps so.
What Smith wants to know is whether Rossiter has any hobbies. If he has, he might work it to keep in with him.
Comrade Jackson has put the matter with his usual admirable clearness. What makes Comrade Rossiter's heart sing? Spillikins? Brass rubbing? The Near Eastern question? The man seems to have no pleasures. What does he do with himself when the day's toil is ended?
No idea. Unless it's football. I saw him once watching Chelsea. I was rather surprised.
Football? Is he strong on any particular team? Have you heard him, in the intervals of business worries, stamping on his desk and yelling, "Buck up, cottagers!" Or, "Lay 'em out, pensioners!"
Not in my hearing, no.
It is time to emulate the great Sherlock Holmes. What was the other team in the modern gladiatorial contest at which you saw Comrade Rossiter?
Manchester United.
And Comrade Rossiter, I should say, hails from Manchester.
I believe he does.
Then I am prepared to bet a small sum that he is nuts on Manchester United. Elementary, my dear fellow. Quite elementary. But here comes the lad in person.
Really, Smith, you always seem to be talking. I've overlooked the matter once, as I did not want to get you into trouble so soon after joining.
The fault was mine. Bannister came in a purely professional spirit to deposit a letter with Comrade Jackson. I engaged him in conversation on the Football League, and I was just trying to correct his view that Newcastle United were the best team playing.
The bank pays you to work, not to talk about professional football.
Just so. Just so.
There is too much talking in this department.
I fear you are right.
It must stop at once.
My own view was that Manchester United were by far the finest team before the public.
Get on with your work, Smith.
Mr. Rossiter stumped off to his desk, where he sat as one in thought. After a decent interval of 5 minutes...
Smith? You called Comrade Rossiter?
Bannister's a fool.
So I thought.
There is no team playing today to touch Manchester United.
Precisely what I said to Comrade Bannister.
Of course, you know something about it.
The study of league football has been my relaxation for years.
Well, we have no time to discuss it now.
Assuredly not, sir. Work before everything.
Some other time when...
We are less busy. Precisely. Did you hear that, Comrade Jay?
Every word.
I'm afraid I have landed Comrade Bannister in the bouillon. But it wasn't a good cause. Half an hour's thoughtful perusal of the footballer's who's who, just find out some elementary facts about Manchester United, and the friendly native is Corral.
Shh, he's looking this way.
To work, Comrade Jay. Work. The hobby of the hustler and the dead beat's dread.
Within a fortnight, Smith could converse attractively with Mr. Rossiter on the subject of Manchester United. He knew what was the favourite breakfast food of J. Turnbull, what Sandy Turnbull wore next to his skin, and had intimated to Mr. Rossiter that Comrade Mike Jackson was a distant relative of the Manchester goalkeeper. On the eighth day, Mr. Rossiter consented to lunch with Smith. On the tenth, he played the host.
You must admit, Comrade Jackson, the entente cordiale with Comrade Rossiter could not be more cordial.
He stopped barking at us.
Precisely. Our bright little Mancunian friend would no more run us in now than if we were the brothers Turnbull. It is time for me to execute Plan B.
Plan B?
Tonight is the night, Comrade Jackson.
Is it?
The haunting of our esteemed manager, Mr. John Bickersdyke.
It takes all sorts to make a world. It took exactly 3,718 members to make the Senior Conservative Club. To Mr. Bickersdyke, for the next week, it seemed as if there was only one. Not that Smith's methods were crude or overdone.
I shall not do the predictable thing, rush up to him at first sighting and lock him in conversation.
No,
most emphatically not. I shall pass him on the club's curiously Gorgonzola-esque marble staircase, and I shall stare.
Stare?
Through my eyeglass.
And stare he did. Mr. Bickersdyke took in the long and lean man in what the female novelist would call faultless evening dress, the fixed stare, the friendly but patronising manner, and sped off at once in search of a waiter. The waiter, duly warned, discovered Smith in the library engrossed in a novel.
Beg pardon, sir. Are you a member of this club?
I am Smith.
A member, sir?
The member. Oh, surely you participated in the general rejoicing which ensued when it was announced that I had been elected.
that perhaps you were too busy working. Oh, if so, I respect you.
I also am a worker. A toiler, not a flatfish. A sizzler, not a squab. Will you tell Mr. Bickersdyke that I am sorry, but I have been elected and have paid my entrance fee and subscription.
The waiter found Mr. Bickersdyke in the lower smoking room.
The gentleman says he is, sir.
Coffee, Benedictine, and a cigar.
Yes, sir.
On the following day, Mr. Bickersdyke met Smith in the club three times. On the day after that, seven. Each time, Smith's smile was friendly but patronising. On the fourth day, Smith made his first remark. The manager was reading the evening paper in a corner when Smith sank gracefully into the chair beside him.
The rain keeps off. Waiter, would you mind bringing me a small cup of coffee? And for you, Mr. Bickersdyke?
Nothing.
And nothing for Mr. Bickersdyke.
Sir.
I see from my morning paper that you are to address a meeting at the Kenningford Town Hall. I shall come and hear you. Our politics differ in some respects. I incline to the socialist view. But nevertheless, I shall listen to your remarks with great interest. I heard from Father this morning.
Don't wish to hear about your father.
What? Oh, you don't mean to say that there is any coolness between Father and you? Knowing as I do what a genuine respect my father has for your great talents, I can only think that there must have been some misunderstanding. Perhaps you would allow me to act as a mediator between...
Smith rediscovered his prey a quarter of an hour later in the card room. He sat beside his table and observed the bridge game with silent interest. Mr. Bickersdyke, never a great performer at the best of times, was so unsettled that in the deciding game of the rubber, he revoked. His bridge partner was apoplectic.
Why did you revoke? You've given the game away. What on earth were you thinking? There was no earthly need to revoke.
How can I keep my attention fixed on the game when that fellow sits there staring at me like a...
I'm sorry if my stare falls short in any way of your ideal of what a stare should be, but I appeal to these gentlemen. Could I have watched the game more quietly?
Of course not. Nobody could have any earthly objection to your behaviour. This gentleman here was utterly careless. One might have expected one's partner at a club like this.
But Bickersdyke had gone, melted silently away like the driven snow.
A somewhat nervous, excitable man, Mr. Bickersdyke.
Is that his name? I must alert the other members. Thank goodness he lost as much as I did. That's some consolation.
When Mike returned from an outing to the Gaiety later that evening, he found Smith in an armchair, with his feet on the mantelpiece, musing on life.
Well, Smith?
Well, Jackson? How was the Gaiety? Good show?
Jolly good. What about Plan Bickersdyke?
Most curious. I should almost be inclined to say that my presence in the Senior Conservative Club tonight irritated him.
Surely not.
He seemed to be giving a spirited imitation of a man about to foam at the mouth.
How very unattractive.
I chatted. His only reply was to leave the room.
Ooh, hardly a clubbable thing to do.
Hardly. I followed him to the card room and paid full attention to his remarkable tactics at bridge.
Was he flattered?
He was not. In fact, he accused me of causing him to revoke.
Oh, slander!
A very curious personality, Comrade Bickersdyke.
So you feel you've got your own back?
Not quite yet. The human conundrum that is Bickersdyke is going into politics.
Is he really?
So they say. I feel somehow that it is now my mission in life to help him in his new career.
It was noted by the observant at the bank the next morning that Mr. Bickersdyke had something on his mind. He passed up the central aisle into his office like an east wind.
Yes, Mr. Bickersdyke?
Ask Mr. Smith. No, never mind.
Shall I fetch Mr. Smith, sir?
I said never mind. Don't stand there gaping at me, man. Go away!
What had made Mr. Bickersdyke change his mind was the sudden realisation that he had no case against Smith. What had Smith done? Nothing worse than stare at him, in a private club, outside office hours.
Yes, Mr. Bickersdyke?
Tell Mr. Rossiter that I wish to see him.
Bannister found Mr. Rossiter engrossed in a post-match post-mortem with Smith.
1-0, Comrade Rossiter. A goal that any right-thinking man would have disallowed.
The referee was dodgy.
Dodgy?
The referee was a robber with an obvious financial interest in the result of the game.
How well you put things.
But United has the moral victory, Comrade Rossiter.
That is exactly how I feel, Mr. Smith.
Excuse me, Mr. Rossiter. Mm. Mr. Bickersdyke wishes to see you immediately.
Ah, Rossiter. I wish to know whether Mr. Smith's work in your department is satisfactory.
Smith, sir?
Is his work proving satisfactory?
Satisfactory is not the word I would choose, Mr. Bickersdyke.
Aha! Just as I suspected.
Exemplary. Incomparable. Proficient to the last detail. That is how I must sum up Mr. Smith's contribution to the postage department.
Indeed.
Hmm. May I venture to observe, sir, that fortune smiled upon the New Asiatic Bank the day that Mr. Smith came to work for us?
Oh, glad to hear it. Yes. That will be all. Please close the door.
On the following evening, Mr. Bickersdyke was due to address a meeting at the Kenningford Town Hall. Mike refused to accompany Smith to this conclave, feeling that he got too many chances in the ordinary way of business of hearing Mr. Bickersdyke speak. He remained at the flat, deep in a novel, while Smith donned his overcoat and went out into the autumnal night on his own.
Our next candidate, ladies and gentlemen, is here tonight to put the case for the Unionist Party. Silence, please, gentlemen, for our next speaker, Mr. John Bickersdyke. Silence, gentlemen!
Fortunately, Mr. Bickersdyke had a penetrating, if harsh, voice. He spoke forcibly about the perils of free trade, the threat of alien immigration, and the necessity of increasing the naval fleet at all costs.
This is no time for half measures. No. We must do our utmost. We must burn our boats.
Excuse me.
In the centre of the hall, a tall figure had risen. Mr. Bickersdyke found himself looking at a gleaming eyeglass which the speaker had just polished and inserted in his eye.
Terribly sorry to interrupt your flow, but how do you propose to strengthen the Navy by burning boats?
Well, what do you say to that, Nigger Dyke?
Yeah, sit down,
folks. May I assert...
Answer the folks' question, Nigger Dyke.
Order, gentlemen!
May I assert the government, gentlemen, achieves nothing worth achieving. And in any case, every individual member of the government takes all the credit for himself. Which reminds me of an amusing experience I had while fishing one summer in the Lake District.
In a volume entitled Three Men in a Boat, there is a story of how the author and a friend go into a riverside inn and see a very large trout in a glass case. They make inquiries about it, and a succession of men assure them, one by one, that the trout was caught by themselves. In the end, the trout turns out to be made of plaster of Paris. Mr. Bickersdyke told that story as an experience of his own.
Now, the lack of genuine merit in that plaster trout, ladies and gentlemen, is only equaled by the lack of genuine merit in the achievements of His Majesty's government!
Excuse me?
Mike was deep in a novel when Smith returned to the flat.
Hello? What the dickens have you been playing at?
I could not say precisely. At one moment it seemed to be rugby football, at another a pantomime rally. However, whatever it was all very bright and interesting.
Somebody got you one on the forehead.
A merchant in a moth-eaten bowler. The sort of chap who discovered that alcohol was a food long before the doctors found it out.
Oh, I wish I'd come with you, Smith. I'd no notion there would be a rag.
Comrade Jacks, you know how wrapped up I am in Comrade Bickersdyke's welfare.
It's all you ever think about.
Precisely. I have spared no effort in my mission to make a decent man of him. Does he appreciate my labours? Not he. I believe the man is beginning to dislike me.
Never mind about Bickersdyke. What happened?
Make a long arm for the shovel, Comrade Jackson, and pile on a few more coals. I thank you. Well, all was going smoothly. Comrade B, in quite good form, free trade, immigration, the Navy, and was going strong for the tape when a regrettable incident occurred.
Ah.
You heckled him.
I was giving the man my full attention when I heard Comrade B inform the meeting that while fishing, he met five men who claimed to have caught the same large stuffed
trout. Dash it all, that's a frightful chestnut.
Purely in a spirit of goodwill, I got up and told him that it was my duty, as a friend, to let him know that a man named Jerome had pinched his story, put it in a book, and got money by it. Mm. Money, mark you, that should, by rights, have been Comrade Bickersdyke's.
What did the Bick do?
He seemed anxious to get on with his speech and slur the matter over. But, well, tactlessly, perhaps, I continued rather to harp on the thing.
How I wish I'd been there.
I was amazed to hear Comrade Bickersdyke urging certain bravos in the audience to turn me out, if ever there was a case of biting the hand that fed him.
So that's how the rag began.
What I might call my party, the earnest investigators, were whistling between their fingers, stamping on the floor and shouting chestnuts, while the opposing party, the bravos, seemed to be trying to do jiu-jitsu tricks with me. I know the cultivated man of affairs should have passed the thing off with a short, careless laugh, but when the bowler-hatted alcohol expert had put this bump on my forehead...
You hit back.
And I was compelled, very reluctantly, to tap the bright boy on the jaw. He took the hint and sat down on the floor. By this time, everybody seemed to be shouting a good deal and hitting everybody else. It was no place for a man of delicate culture, so I edged towards the door and drifted out.
What do you intend to say to Bickersdyke tomorrow?
There shall be no constraint between Comrade Bickersdyke and myself.
I shouldn't think there would be. I wish I could come and hear you.
I wish you could. It is my growing fear that Comrade Bickersdyke and I will never thoroughly understand and appreciate one another. Life bulges with these tragedies.
Don't let it keep you awake at night. By the way, Manchester United won this afternoon. You'd better sweat up some of the details for tomorrow.
So, the Mancunians pushed the bulb into the meshes beyond the uprights no fewer than four times, did they? Bless the dear boys, what spirits they do enjoy. Sweet dreams, Comrade Jackson.
Mr. Bickersdyke sat in his private room at the New Asiatic Bank with a pile of newspapers before him. At least the casual observer would have said it was Mr. Bickersdyke. In reality, it was an active volcano in the shape and clothes of the bank manager. He picked up a paper, opened it, and began searching the columns. He had not far to look. The column was headed, Amusing Heckling. He sent for Smith.
You wish to confer with me, Mr. Bickersdyke?
Well, Mr. Smith, what have you to say?
I gather that the bank rate remains unchanged.
Your explanation of what occurred last night. Speak up, sir.
A deplorable affair. However, we must not judge these rough, uneducated men too harshly. In a time of excitement, the emotions of the lower classes are easily stirred. Where you or I...
Enough buffoonery, Mr. Smith.
Buffoonery, sir?
I'm beginning to think that you must be perfectly mad.
But surely, sir, when a merchant has attached himself to your collar, can you do less than smite him on the other cheek?
I'm alluding to your behaviour during my speech.
An excellent speech.
You seem absolutely determined to annoy me.
No, no.
You follow me about in my club.
Our club?
Be good enough not to interrupt. You attend meetings of which I'm speaking. You behave in a perfectly imbecile manner.
Now, you exaggerate.
Extremely bad policy on your part, Smith. The New Asiatic Bank is no place for humour.
I entirely agree with you, sir. This bank is no place for humour.
Very well, then.
And I am never humorous in it. I arrive punctually, and I work earnestly until my labours are completed.
But that is neither here nor there.
If you require expert testimony, you might consult Mr. Rossiter.
Mr. Rossiter? Ah!
In any case, surely your jurisdiction ceases after office hours. You could not, for instance, dismiss me from the service of the bank if we were partners at bridge at the club and I happened to revoke.
I can dismiss you, Mr. Smith, for studied insolence, whether in the office or not.
I rather doubt that.
much as it would pain me to bring a case against the bank for wrongful dismissal.
Wrongful dismissal?
A legal term, comrade. I hardly think that you would relish the prospect of explaining to the bank's directors that its shareholders must pay a fine of whatever a discriminating jury cares to award me, especially when they hear that I am guilty of nothing more than staring at you in the middle of a rubber and making an honest intervention at a public lecture.
Honest intervention? Sabotage?
Perhaps we need to go back a little, sir, at the time when you paid us that very welcome weekend visit at our house in August.
If you hope to make capital out of the fact that I have been a guest of your father...
No, not at all. My point is this. It cannot be denied that there was some slight bickering between us due to your unfortunate ignorance of the great game of cricket.
I am a man of commerce.
Precisely. And you conceived the happy notion of getting me into this bank under the impression that once I was in, you would be able to... Now, what was your expression? Give me beans. Now, don't you think that if you give me the sack, although my work is entirely satisfactory, you will be by way of admitting that you bit off rather more than you could chew?
How dare you?
The whole painful affair reminds me of the story of Agesilaus and the petulant pterodactyl, which, as you have never heard it, I will now proceed to relate. Suffice it to say that Comrade Agesilaus interfered with the pterodactyl, which was doing him no harm, and the intelligent creature, whose motto was Nemo me impune lacessit, turned and bit him. Bit him good and hard, so that Agesilaus ever afterwards had a distaste for pterodactyls. Let us draw the parallel.
Now listen here! You
are Agesilaus. I am the petulant pterodactyl. You took me from a happy home simply to get me into this place under you and give me beans. But curiously, the major portion of that vegetable seems to be coming to you.
Administer
the push if you like. Personally, I should advise you to stick it out. At any moment, I may fall from my present high standard of industry, and then you have me, so to speak, where the hair is crisp. Now, with your permission, I will rejoin my department, where my absence is doubtless causing comment, and possibly dismay.
Smith!
Comrade Jackson,
did you get the push?
Not this time, but we must be ever vigilant. Comrade Bickersdyke will be waiting, I fear, to catch us bending.
How on earth did you convince the Bicker to let you stay?
I employed the same arsenal I have used throughout my boyhood and school days. Rhetoric, good manners, humour, panache. Now, let us make our mid-morning postal delivery, Comrade Jackson. We shall celebrate with porridge and coffee, and live to fight another day.
In episode 2 of Smith in the City by P.G. Woodhouse, dramatised by Marcy Cahan, Woodhouse was played by Simon Williams. Smith was Nick Caldicott and Mike Inar Mirza. Mr. Bickersdyke was played by Stephen Critchlow and Mr. Rossiter and the Scottish Peer by Chris Pavlin. The bridge player and the waiter were Dan Starkey and Bannister was played by Robert Lonsdale. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Original music was by Clive Swift. Smith in the City was directed by Abigail de Fleming.